This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're almost 2 months into the final decade of the millennium. Uh-oh, if the prophets of doom are right, 1999 could bring the end of the world. On the other hand, some say the year 2000 will usher in a new age of higher consciousness. End-of-the-century prophecies and fantasies are the subject of Hillel Schwartz's new book, Century's End, A Cultural History of the Fin de Siècle from the 990s through the 1990s. Schwartz is also the author of a cultural history of dieting called Never Satisfied. Well, we looked up Hillel Schwartz in the literary reference book Contemporary Authors. In the part of the entry where authors usually describe their hobbies, Schwartz says, "I'm most interested in how the world is going to end."
I did that partly because I felt that I had been working on that subject for a long time. I'm not particularly concerned, in fact, about how the world is going to end per se, but rather how we always think about and react to notions of finality, especially when we get ground into groups and we begin to think about the world ending and what will we do with our children. The group that I earlier studied about 1706 had the idea that the world was going to end at that time, and they had the problem then of what to do with children. What do you do when the world is going to end? Do you educate your children? Do you worry about your children at all? So when you come to the end of things, one of the major concerns people seem to have is with the continuity of generations and what kind of world will be if there is something after that end.
Does the end of a century and the end of a millennium bring on a lot of end-of-the-world type thinking?
A great deal. There's a compounded interest now, of course, in the ends of things because we're coming both to the end of a century, which naturally encourages such thoughts, at least since the 1300s, and the end of a millennium, which encourages even greater prospects of a finality or a new age coming into being after that.
Why do you think that just like the changing of numbers, you know, because that's really what it is, should bring on this apocalyptic thinking?
Well, yes, it's arbitrary. But it's no more arbitrary and no less arbitrary than coming to the age of 40 and suddenly coming to grips with your mortality. So we seem to see in our own ages significant numbers. And this is a tradition that's gone back farther than the Greeks with the idea of climacterics, critical points in one's life every 7 or 14 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're heading to the year 2000. Now, the only other evidence we have of how people responded to the end of a millennium was, I guess, in the year 1000. Did you come across any record of what the expectations were, what the predictions were as that first millennium ended?
First, I have to say there is a legend which we cannot extirpate no matter what we do as historians, no matter what we do looking for the records. The legend says that in the year 999, people panicked, believing that the world would come to an end in that year 1000 or that the Antichrist would come. The legend has it that people gave away their goods, that they went on pilgrimages, they went to shrines, and we have no good evidence that any of that occurred. But I cannot persuade anybody anywhere that that's not true. At the same time, however, we do have mounting evidence in the 990s of an astonishing peace movement of lay people, peasants, knights, their ladies, and churchmen gathering in assemblies in France and also in Germany to try to ensure first a truce of God and then later a peace of God, at least in the realms in which they had some control. And these peace movements, as signs that you need some kind of significant change at the end of a century and at the end of a millennium, seem to recur at the ends of centuries, and we see it now around us at the end of this century.
Hillel Schwartz is my guest. He's a cultural historian, and he's the author of the new book, Century's End, which is about all the predictions at the end of centuries and at the end of millennia. Well, it seems to me now that we're approaching the year 2000, there are new ways to imagine the end of the world. We can imagine nuclear disaster. We can imagine the world ending in some kind of greenhouse effect or terrible pollution, interplanetary wars on a lot of people's minds.
Yes.
Do you think we're getting more creative now in predictions for the end of the world?
And more global. It used to be that the end of the world would come only to the people you knew about, and now it comes not only to the Earth, but perhaps to the galaxy as well. The sense that the world would come to an end with devastation, either natural or man-made, has been part of the phenomena at the ends of centuries for a long time. What gets more and more creative, rather, is our sense of what kind of new ages we can have. If you look at the scenarios for devastation, they're pretty much the same. The only difference is that with the nuclear, we have a sense that this can happen more quickly. But with our visions of what can happen after the turn of the century, these seem to be slightly more creative now because we have a higher sense of what our technology can do and also a greater foreboding about what our technology may not finally give us.
So do you think that the New Age movement has something to do with the approach of the year 2000 and that kind of a end of the millennium type thinking?
Oh, certainly. Although this Aquarius phenomenon, the Aquarian conspiracy and the rest, is not necessarily centered on the year 2000 per se. It's been growing in momentum ever since the 1970s as an end-of-century phenomenon. The New Age idea, in fact, comes from the late 12th century from an abbot in Italy who conceived of the world in three historical stages, a stage of the Father, a stage of the Son, and a stage of the Holy Ghost. He believed at the end of the 12th century that they were about to enter the stage of the Holy Ghost. This was going to be the New Age. And with the New Age would come a new avant-garde of spiritual men, more pure and more dedicated to the salvation of the soul and also to the salvation of the territories of Christendom. This New Age phenomenon, then, as a Third Age phenomenon, has become popular, and you can see the melding between the New Age rhetoric that's popular with channeling books and popular with astral magnetism and UFO reports, melded to the New Age literature and rhetoric concerning business, the third millennium of the business world, the third industrial revolution, sense that you must enter a third American century. These are two different worlds coming together with the same kind of concern about a new age.
We use the expression New Age rhetoric. You've been reading a lot of New Age materials. Do you find the writing to be hard to get through often?
Well, what happens is that in New Age materials, in order for them to explain why it's so important for us to be concerned at just this point, the material becomes highly numerological and astrological. These are two phenomena, of course, that have been with us for a long time, in fact, since at least the 12th century. But at the ends of centuries, the numbers become suddenly more significant. And so the number play becomes wilder and more extraordinary in order to convince us about the extreme significance of these numbers.
Well, I want to quote something that you quote in your book, Centuries End, and this was written about the harmonic convergence. And this is by, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, José Arguelles.
Yes.
And it's from a book called The Mayan Factor, which was, I think, a Mayan analysis of using Mayan history to understand the 1987 harmonic convergence.
Using, among other things, the Mayan calendar, yes.
Okay. So he writes about that point at which the counterspin of history finally comes to a momentary halt and the still imperceptible spin of post-history commences. And he writes about the exponential acceleration of the wave of harmonic history as it phases into a moment of unprecedented synchronization and of a major evolutionary upgrading of the light-life radiogenic process. Hard to understand.
There are, in those few sentences you've read, a wonderful melding of different sources of centuries and feelings. One is the feeling that you have to come with a new energy source into the new century. At the end of centuries, you feel full of decay and degeneration. You look around you and see the world's falling apart faster than you can ever put it back together again. And you think there has to be a new source of energy. So talking about wave harmonics, talking about, as we do now, superconductors and cold fusion, these are part of that feeling that you need a new energy source. Then there's that second feeling that everything seems to be coincidental now. So there's a key word, a code word of synchronicity at the ends of centuries, that everything seems to mean something about the same thing now. And the third part of all this incomprehensibility that you were reading has to do with our feeling that if we are coming to a significant point, people must have anticipated how significant it would be. And so there must be a whole prophetic literature to look back to, just as the people in the French Revolution, just before the French Revolution occurred and during it, looked back to see what prophecies had predicted the French Revolution, including prophecies by Nostradamus. So we now, in the year 2000, have about 500 years worth of prophecies to look back to say, this is what other people have expected for the year 2000. And Arguelles just goes them one step further and says, this is what the Mayans have been expecting for at least 2,500 years.
I'm sure you've been keeping up with a lot of apocalyptic literature and end of the century, movies and books and so on. Have any of them struck you as being as particularly tapping into popular thinking or popular fears about the end of the millennium?
The one I would talk about is Whitley Strieber's book Communion, which talks about aliens from unidentified flying objects abducting children, sucking something out of them, secrets about their biology, about the universe, about mankind, then returning them to live as somewhat unconsciously terrified strangers. It's a book which, on the surface, does not appear to be about the end of a century, but it is quite apocalyptic and quite terrifying and returns us to this theme of concern about the continuity of generations. And it becomes a movie as well. So it takes on a kind of potent imagery for us, this feeling that at the ends of centuries, we have put a burden on our children because they are our emissaries into the next century, at the same time that we worry about whether we can even grant them a planet where the species are no longer endangered, where the tropical rainforests still stand, leads us to this concern about our children as perhaps not having any more a childhood, as if the childhood were sucked out of them. So at the ends of centuries, for a book like Communion to appear, for people to be suddenly looking around at each other as possible aliens, is a truly significant sign of how concerned we are about the continuity of generations.
Well, two things I want to mention. One is that the movie based on Communion was a real flop. And also that Strieber's previous book was a real apocalyptic book. It was War Day. It was about the near end of the world through nuclear war.
Yes, it was. And it had as its major hero a set of survivors who looked at the world and thought that it wasn't going to survive much longer even after the nuclear war because there was flu and other disease. So yes, inherent in what he was doing was both the thriller and a sense of apocalypse.
Do you want to warn us to be careful of what we buy into as we near the year 2000?
I wish I could feel that my warnings would do any good, but they won't.
Well, warn us anyway.
Well, what I'd rather do is create in everyone a consciousness about these two contrary motifs we keep feeling about anxiety and enthusiasm, and then say, well, no matter what, we're going to have these feelings at this end of a century, so why don't we use the energy generated by them to do something with them as opposed to becoming more confused, more complex, and use the year 2000, regardless of the debate about when the century and the millennium ends, use the full year 2000 as a way to implement things that you thought you didn't have the energy for before.
Sure.
Okay, so we'll all abandon our fields and devote ourselves to humanity in the year 2000, Terry.
See you there. Hillel Schwartz, can we force a connection here between diet obsession and the end of the century?
We can try one. That connection would be between all of the energy stuff I was talking about and the concerns people have at the ends of centuries with being revitalized and the diets that we now have at the end of the century. No one has come up with, and I think they should probably in the next couple of years come up with a millennium diet. But to force the comparison as best I can right here, although I wrote the books in the reverse order, the people now who are most promoting the most successful diets are constantly promising us not just a loss of weight and not just a change of appearance, but also a truly rejuvenated body. And the same time that our natural food stores carry energy bars, the diets themselves are promising that no matter what kind of regimen you're on, you're going to feel far more energetic. So all of that fatigue you're feeling from carrying around, and that's the words they use, carrying around this extra heavy weight and being immersed in all of this deadly fat. Well, let's take this, they say, all the diet doctors and the diet promoting agencies and Weight Watchers. Let's take all of this fear you have about heaviness and drowsiness and death and turn it around, change your life, and suddenly you will become not only a new person, but a person fit for a new century.
Have you been collecting diet literature? Brochures and advertisements?
Oh, yes. I have files and files not only of the literature, but of about 500 diet books published before 1950. You might, if you look at any bookstore now, realize that a lot of diet books are on the market. But there's actually about 300 to 350 each year on the market since the 1950s. Before that, the first truly popular best-selling diet book came out right after World War I. During the war, Herbert Hoover, as part of the U.S. Food Administration, had been concerned to get people to change their diets and had begun to emphasize the importance of certain kinds of protein. But after the war, Lulu Hunt Peters, a woman who had syndicated columns in many newspapers across the country, published the first big-selling diet book with stick figure illustrations. And from then on, that book was reprinted a number of times. And then came a number of other books in the 1920s, which began to develop a series of other methods for dieting. So what happens if you look back at all this literature, this ephemera, as well as the diet books, is that quite often the diets in the 20s are the same as the diets in the 80s. The grapefruit diet was called the Hollywood diet in the 1925. But what happens is that each generation develops a new rationale for why an old diet will work, and that new rationale fits the cultural principles alive at the time. So the diets now, which emphasize vitamins and proteins and energy, are not diets that are necessarily distinctly different from those in the 50s or the 30s or even in 1915, but they have an entirely different rationale to them which fits the cultural presuppositions of our time.
Well, how does the grapefruit diet of now and yesteryear compare in its rationale?
Well, originally, the grapefruit diet was there because people had made the assumption since the 17th century that if you took something acidic, it would dissolve the fat inside you, the way acids dissolve things outside in the real world. And when they got inside your body, the acids would dissolve the fat and it wouldn't be absorbed, or it would be unloosened, unhinged, as it were, from the canals of your body. Now the grapefruit diet is something connected to vitamin C and connected to energy and connected to a sense of California, Florida, vitality, sunshine.
Does it disturb you when you turn on television and you see food ad after food ad from companies that are allegedly making diet food products? So we're being sold foods that will help us slim down, and these commercials are just making us really hungry for food.
I think we cooperate with the advertisers. We would like to have foods which taste scrumptious, but which give us no calories. We would like to have foods which have all essence, but no other properties at all. It's almost a metaphysical desire on our part. So when I see all those ads on TV, I relate it to this desire on our part for all of these diet foods that will give us taste without substance and that will give us the essence of life without weighing us down, a kind of ultimate weightlessness. By the way, there is an irony, as you might realize, to much of this advertising, because these huge conglomerate corporations very often own the fattening food products as well as the diet food supplements. So, for example, Heinz, which produces the ketchup for all those hamburgers, also owns Weight Watchers.
Well, have there been any books written yet about how at the end of the millennium, when we reach the year 2000, there will be fabulous foods without calories?
Oh, yes. There have been several articles.
Seriously?
In most of the major dailies and weeklies. Yes, you guessed it. About food in the year 2000, and what will it be? First of all, it would have, as an extension of the whole dieting principle, it would have tremendous taste, tremendous flavor, but it would not have great substance. It would be a lot of fish done in new ways. We are disenchanted, by the way, with that old image of people popping pills like spacemen up in orbit, eating their dinners with little pills. I have to tell you the story, which fits both the end of the millennium and the dieting craze. In the 1890s, the most widespread image from all of the scientific extrapolations of what would happen by the end of the next century was that people would sit around elegant dining tables while butlers served them on these grand silver trays little pills, which were labeled roast beef and leg of mutton. We, at the end of this century, have the same desire, but we no longer think that we can do simply with the pill, because what we want, as all of the taste scientists say to us now, we want mouth feel. So at the end of the century, we're going to get mouth feel, but we're not going to have the calories in the food itself.
Well, Hillel Schwartz, I wish you happy eating and a good end of the century.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for talking with us. My guest has been Hillel Schwartz. He's a cultural historian, and he has a new book called Century's End, which is a cultural history of the end of century and end of millennium thinking. And he also has a book that's just come out in paperback called Never Satisfied, a cultural history of diets, fantasies, and fat. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.